This week on Disaffected, the New York Times continues to normalize the idea of vaccine passports. The Biden administration guts Title IX protections for women and girls so that boys who claim to be girls can take over girls' sports. And the Department of Justice tells states that ban mutilating gender surgery on minors that their bans are unconstitutional. Then we'll look at two examples of disturbed people who spill out the contents of their violent fantasies while claiming it's other people who are dangerous to them. And one of them is a Yale psychiatrist who says that it's white people, not her, who are psychopathic. All that and more this week on Disaffected. Welcome to Disaffected. I'm Joshua Slocum, and this is the show where we talk about politics and culture through a psychological lens, with particular attention paid to abuse dynamics and the kinds of abuse dynamics that show up when you're dealing with people and situations that run on personality disorder rules, cluster B personality disorders, borderline, narcissistic, histrionic, and antisocial. The hypothesis of this show is that these abuse dynamics, the deception, the lying, the exploitation of other people, the false victimhood, all the things that are very common to abuse situations that we're familiar with when it comes to child abuse and domestic abuse in the home, are not just abuse dynamics that happen in the home. They are becoming characteristic of our broader public conversation, particularly in terms of the cultural priorities of the left. And I used to think it was just the social justice left. I used to think it was just the worst part of the left. But unfortunately, these dynamics are starting to control the entire cultural conversation on the mainstream left as well. So a little bit of housekeeping. If you don't know, we have a website. And if you are interested in following us, if you're interested in looking at our video content, if you're interested in our audio content, you can find all of that on all the platforms that you are familiar with. Anywhere that you ordinarily get your podcasts, you will find us. Just visit our website. We've got great big graphics and links there. Disaffected.fm. That's D-I-S-A-F-F-E-C-T-E-D. Disaffected.fm. So we're going to do a couple of topical news items first, and later in the show, we've got some really good crazy for you, including a Yale psychiatrist who fantasizes publicly about shooting white people in the head. Charming. So, this week, in our never-ending COVID war, the mainstream media, the corporate media, the received wisdom opinion makers really don't want us to get out of COVID land. This has been an absolute boon for them. It's given them the ability to sit in judgment over people. It's given them the ability to constantly stoke fear, irrational and excessive fear, so that the population is compliant with masks, with social distancing, and with their favorite part, vaccinations. I think people forget this, and I even forget this from time to time. I was talking to a coworker this week, and I realized that halfway through the conversation we were having about vaccines, I had forgotten for a moment that these vaccines are, in fact, experimental. These vaccines are unlike all other vaccines that you are already familiar with and that you may already have had: measles, mumps, rubella, polio, etc. All of those went through all of their clinical trials. They got full FDA approval. The three vaccines that are out right now for the coronavirus are experimental. They are being given out under emergency authorization from the FDA. That isn't necessarily a bad thing in and of itself. It's not that there are no situations that reasonable people could conceive of where we might want to say, looks like we're facing clear and present danger. and we don't have time to wait 5 years or 10 years for all the clinical trials, we're going to make a cost-benefit analysis and say, let's go ahead with this. So that isn't necessarily nuts by itself, but we need to remember that these vaccines are experimental. We are in the experimental stage right now. You are a participant in this experiment. They're not fully approved yet. Well, you wouldn't know it. This week, the New York Times, my God, this is not the same paper I remember from even 7 or 8 years ago. Here's an image I'm going to put up here. I love how they do this. It's a pair of hands holding a white card, a vaccination card. Look what we offer to you. It's very cuddly, isn't it? Headline. For now, the best way to show you've been vaccinated against the coronavirus in the U.S. is a simple white card. Here's everything you need to know about it. And underneath it says, what you need to know about your vaccine card. And again, they just repeat the thing. Notice the language here. Notice the tone. For now, the best way to show you've been vaccinated against the coronavirus in the U.S. is a simple white card. They seem to be putting this forward. When I read this and I read between the lines and I think, what is it that they're actually trying to tell us? I think what they're really trying to say is, this is good, this is normal. And what's this? This is the idea that you should be expected to and you should want to have to prove your vaccination status before you get into a ballpark, before you get into a nightclub, before you get into, oh, what's the latest one, a Bruce Springsteen concert, a museum. What they're really saying here is, this is normal. You want this. This is normal. You like this. You are waiting for a national vaccine card. But in the meantime, this is what you can do. This is something you want. This is something normal people want. Because this little bit here, this image, this is just one of countless stories like this that the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC put out every single day. The drumbeat to normalize the idea of vaccine passports is constant. And again, folks, the coronavirus, COVID-19, more than 99% of people who contract this virus recover from it. This is not Ebola. It's not bubonic plague. It's not the Black Death. I'm willing to have a conversation. If we should have a pandemic that had an extraordinarily high fatality rate, I'm willing to have the conversation about whether we should take some drastic measures. I think most reasonable people would be willing to have that conversation. But we are being told to have that conversation as if that were true. It is not true. It's not true. This virus generally kills old people and people with underlying complications. And no, I hate that I have to say this. I hate that I have to say it, but I have to say it every single time, because if I do one show and I don't say this, it's going to be the first thing that somebody says back. No. I don't want your grandmother to die. I do not want your friend with diabetes to die. When I say this virus kills old people and people with underlying health problems, there is not an unspoken, silent other sentence there that says, and that's okay because those people are expendable. This is obvious. It should be obvious. Maybe in another era it would be obvious. But you have to say this stuff because people are thinking in black and white and they're frightened out of their minds. So there's that. That's enough of the New York Times. I won't subject you to any more this week, but there'll be more later. A couple other things hit the news, and I've talked many times on the show about the Biden administration's approach to transgender issues. The pushing of the left's project to normalize the idea that humans, I was going to say adult humans, but it's not just humans, it's not just adults, is it? It's also children and adolescents, pushing the idea that it's normal and just a natural part of human variation to believe that you have a woman's essence inside of you if you're a man, and to believe that you have a man's essence inside of you if you are a woman. They want to normalize this so hard. And they've been doing it for so long, and so many compassionate, well-meaning people on the liberal side of the aisle have been taken in by this that we treat it as if it's normal. It's not normal. It's a sign of mental illness. It's a sign of mental distress. And again, as a reminder, somebody who's had mental illness for a long part of my life, as somebody who knows and loves people who have mental illness, that's not an insult. It is not an insult. It's not a denigration to say that believing you are the opposite sex is a psychiatric delusion. It is a delusion. It does cause suffering. The suffering is not alleviated by having, by forcing the entire world to pretend that your delusion is real. But that's what we're expected to do. This week, the Biden administration has extended Title IX protections to transgender students. What is Title IX? Title IX is part of our federal code that aims to protect mainly women. I mean, it protects people of either sex, but aims to protect women from discrimination and a lack of opportunity on the basis of their sex. So Title IX has often been implicated in... Title IX is what created girls' sports in public schools and in colleges, right? Female-only sports, so that women and girls had a chance to compete with other able-bodied women and girls. Obviously, if you put girls and boys or men and women all on one sports team, with the exception of sports that don't rely on... primarily on physical body strength, perhaps, like, I don't know, polo, horse sports. I'm sure there's a proper name for horse sports. I don't know what it is. If you put men and women on the same team, the men are going to beat them almost every single time. That's the reason that we have sex-segregated sports. So now the Biden administration is trying to extend Title IX protections, and has extended. I don't know what the legal mechanism is, but these things are all going to end up before the Supreme Court, to transgender students, meaning that they now consider it illegal discrimination and a violation of Title IX if schools do not allow boys to compete on the girls' sports team. And if you say that, what I just said, in front of people who've been brainwashed by this, they won't even let you finish the sentence. The first thing they're going to come back and say is, they're not boys, they're girls. They're trans girls. Trans girls are girls. Trans girls are girls. Trans girls are girls. A repeated mantra. People don't have to repeat mantras like robots out of the Stepford Wives unless they know that they're lying. Trans girls aren't girls. The prefix trans... I got into an argument with some people on social media about this last week. To a close approximation, the prefix trans functionally, effectively means not. It simply is a not in front of whatever word it's describing. Trans girls are not girls. Trans women are not women. In the real world, that's what it actually means. So... then we have the Department of Justice, the DOJ, claiming that state laws, which have recently been passed, and I think there are eight of them, state laws that make it illegal for public schools to put boys on girls' sports teams, to allow boys to trample through the girls' locker room. The Department of Justice is now saying that these are illegal. And I want to read you from, let's see, which wire service was it? this one, the first one. Notice the framing here. This is from U.S. News and World Report. The U.S. Department of Justice on Thursday challenged bans involving transgender people that target athletes in West Virginia and children in Arkansas, slamming them as violations of federal law. Notice the framing. The DOJ challenged bans that target athletes. Do you see that? Target. That language is not neutral. It's not merely expository reporting. It's a value judgment, and it's meant to evoke an emotion. And it's meant to tell you what the writer thinks and what U.S. News and World Report thinks and what you should think if you're a decent person. This is targeting them. They're victims. They're in the crosshairs. Somebody's going to shoot at them. Do you see how loaded this is? All because some states actually recognize that men and women are different and that girls have a right to compete with other girls and they have a right to privacy in the locker room. Oh, no, no, no. It's not that. It's not about protecting their legitimate interests. It's about targeting these poor, vulnerable trans children, which, of course, don't exist. There's no such thing as a trans child. A trans child is a creation of modern transgender activism. It is a created, fictive identity that has been created to give a plausible, natural backstory to justify the fetishes and psychiatric delusions of adults. That's all it is. There's no such thing as a trans child. Whew. Going on from U.S. News and World Report. Department of Justice filed statements of interest in lawsuits that seek to overturn new laws in those states. In West Virginia, a law prohibits transgender athletes from competing in female sports. Arkansas became the first state to ban gender-confirming treatments or surgery for transgender youth. Again, I'm going to go back and point the framing out to you. Arkansas became the first state to ban gender-confirming surgeries. Gender-confirming surgeries. This is what we used to call sex change surgery. That was not a great name because no one can actually change sex. We can cosmetically mutilate the body and create some approximation of the secondary sex characteristics of the opposite sex, but we can't actually change someone's sex. But they call it today gender-confirming surgery. Huh. So it's just confirming what we already know. Why does it need to be confirmed? If you have a physical body with penis and testicles, why do you need to have your womanhood confirmed? If you're really a woman, as they say, and they do say, trans women are women, why do you need surgery to confirm that? And if they don't call it gender confirming, they call it gender affirming. Gender affirming care. Oh, so cuddly. Isn't that nice? Isn't that warm and soft? Isn't that loving? No, it's not. It's brutality. Here's how the AP put it, the Associated Press, about extending Title IX protections to allow boys to compete in girls' sports. Do you get how perverse this is? Title IX was a legal watershed that established that women and girls have a right to equal protection under the law. And one of the ways that equal protection and equal opportunity is afforded is by creating girls and women's sports. And now they're taking it and they're turning it literally on its head. They're inverting the meaning. So the AP says, the decision, which Education Secretary Miguel Cardona teased in an exclusive interview with ESPN last week, comes as a growing number of states are considering legislation that would ban transgender youth from participating in sports. There it is again, transgender youth, these people who don't exist, but who have been discursively created by our modern conversation, our modern lying. As it stands, 8 states ban transgender students from participating in girls and women's competition. Again, dishonest framing. Listen to it. 8 states ban transgender students from participating. No. They ban boys from competing as girls on girls' teams. That gives you a different emotion, doesn't it? It's not quite as aggrieved. You're not quite as outraged, are you, when we tell the truth? That's why they don't tell the truth. And they do say, finally, notably, it's unclear whether the interpretation has teeth and to what extent it stands to alter state laws. Yes, it really is unclear. And this will go to the Supreme Court. I'm not going to make any predictions about what the Supreme Court will say. I no longer know what to believe. I don't know what to expect of people like this. I never thought that I'd be sitting in a seat like this. I never thought that people like me, maybe people like you, would be unable to have these conversations with our friends without being looked at as if we'd suddenly grown a devil's tail from people who've known us for years. But that's what's happened in this culture war created and stoked by the left. But here we are. I want to talk a little bit about how eager we are culturally in the United States and in the West generally to believe claims of persecution, claims of victimhood, claims of oppression. And we are. We're very eager. We've been trained. There has been a steady drumbeat over the years that has told us that the United States, for example, that the best way to characterize the United States is a place of discrimination, of hatred, of unequal opportunity, of powerful people in a culturally favored position whose primary motivation and most preferred action is to thwart other people, to climb up the ladder and then kick it away so nobody can get up after them. We have been trained by the cultural left to see ourselves, if we're white, if we're heterosexual, if we're mainstream in any way, as oppressors, and that anyone with a darker shade of skin, anyone in a minority religion, anyone in a minority sexual orientation is automatically and ipso facto a victim. And even if we don't know it, and even if we don't mean to, and even if we treat them nicely, we're oppressing them. We have imbibed this. I imbibed this. I believed it. I was one of these liberals for a very long time. It's not true. It's not true. And this whole project is demoralizing. The goal is to demoralize you. I've certainly felt demoralized. I know a lot of people who have. It's demoralizing because it destabilizes reality. It makes you look at yourself, even though you can't detect any conscious predilection on your part to hurt other people, to think of them as less, or to take opportunities away from them, but you have been convinced that you're doing it even when you're not aware of it, like you're sleepwalking through life. That's demoralizing. And when you internalize that, and that's the way you see yourself, and that's the way you begin to look at other people around you, trying to figure out, you know, how are they actually acting oppressively, even if I can't see it? You feel guilty. You get angry at people that you shouldn't be angry at. You get angry at yourself for things that you didn't do. It's demoralizing. But the result of the degree to which we have swallowed the idea that most of us are oppressors, or that we're participating in or we're funding oppressive systems every single day as we go about our lives, is that we swallow bullshit. We believe lies and histrionic, made up theatrical set pieces because these confirm our suspicions. They confirm everything that the cultural left has told us, you know, that this is the kind of country we are. So we buy hoaxes, don't we? Remember Jussie Smollett from last year, the actor from the television show drama The Empire, who claimed that when he was out walking at night in Chicago, that he was assailed or assaulted at 2 a.m. by a couple of guys who were gay bashing him, who dumped some sort of unknown liquid on him as if, it, you know, the implication being that it was some sort of caustic chemical, and that they put a noose around his neck. A noose. Really. A noose. And said, "This is MAGA country." MAGA, of course, being the initialism for Trump's slogan, "Make America Great Again." And we all know that anything Trump said is automatically wrong. It's automatically the worst thing possible. So we hear that, oh, look how terrible it is. Look at how people are treating other people now that our terrible, illegitimate president has legitimized walking around and assaulting actors at night. with nooses. Flagrant nonsense. But there have been many other instances, many other hoaxes like this. I was trying to think of a few, and I came up with, do you remember the alleged gang rape at Duke University in 2006? I do, because I remember believing it. I remember believing it because, you know, we know of famous cases of horrific gang rapes that have happened. You remember the movie The Accused? I think it was 1987 with Jodie Foster. In which a woman, I remember her character name, it was Sarah, I don't remember the woman's actual name. It was based on a true story. Went to a bar called Big Dan's in Fall River, Massachusetts, and got gang raped on a pinball machine. And it was made into a very compelling movie with Jodie Foster. I remember being horrified at that. And I had a sort of second, third degree connection to it because the mother of a very close friend of mine was the teacher of the woman who was portrayed as the character Sarah by Jodie Foster. We knew that this had actually taken place, and it was horrendous. But I believed this. Well, what actually happened in the Duke rape case in 2006 was, you know, apparently a group of frat guys hired some strippers to perform at a party, and a young woman named Crystal Mangum showed up with another stripper, and then she claimed that she was gang raped by the lacrosse team. And on further examination, after huge sturm und drang and lots of media coverage, the case absolutely fell apart. It didn't happen. And then this one's very troubling to me. Remember the case of Matthew Shepard, the young gay man who was brutally murdered in Laramie, Wyoming in 1998? He was, in fact, brutally murdered. His skull was bashed in, and he was left for dead tied to a fence post. But the entire narrative around the Matthew Shepard murder was that this was a homophobic assault, and I believed it. Almost everyone believed it. There were a few people out there who had their skeptic hats on, and frankly, they had to be made of braver stuff than I was back then, because to even slightly indicate with a look on your face that maybe this whole thing didn't hang together was cultural suicide. How dare you? Why are you trying to cover up homophobic murders? Well, turns out Matthew Shepard very likely was not murdered for being gay. It looks like he was involved in drugs and the unsavory economic world and lifestyle that drug peddling is, and he got killed in a drug deal gone wrong. Doesn't make it okay. Doesn't make it less of a brutal and violent murder. But this was used to make the very real issue of homophobia and violent assault against gay people seem far worse and far more endemic than it really was. It's not okay to do that. It's not okay to distort reality in service of a higher purpose. What higher purpose? Making gay people more terrified than they needed to be? Making onlookers more suspicious of people around them than they needed to be? That's not helping. That's probably enough for this segment. Come back, because on the other side of the break, we are going to look at an instance of hiding in plain sight. A predatory young man who calls himself a trans woman, who uses all the emotional tactics that have been made available to him by the cultural left to make himself appear to be a victim when he's actually confessing how deeply deranged he is. So, see you after the break. Hey, listeners, guess what? We're on Patreon now. Bringing you this show costs money. Would you chip in to help? Go to patreon.com/disaffected. That's patreon.com/DISAFFECTED. Thank you. Want to talk back to us? You're in luck. Call our listener line and leave us a message. 202-979-2480. That's 202-979-2480. And remember, we do reserve the right to play messages on the air. Welcome back. Now we're going to do some translation. Ha, 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 ha. I actually love doing this, and I, from the feedback I've gotten from you guys, I think you like it too. Being able to look at the words that manipulative people are saying in order to induce emotion and to propel action in other people and translating them into what's really going on, I have a great deal of fun doing it, but I think it's also a very important life skill. And I do this on the show not just because it's fun for me, but because I would like to help anybody watching and listening to be able to do this yourself. This is reading between the lines. It's reading for intent. And I think we don't do enough of it. I think we take too much at face value. So this is a Twitter thread. I was going to say it astonished me, but I can't really honestly say that. This is a Twitter thread, and I've seen many like this, by a so-called trans woman who calls himself Lefty Femme Girl. Ooh-woo, U-W-U.
Ooh, so cute. You're so cute.
And the picture he uses for himself, I have no idea whether or not this is actually him, but is a small portrait of what appears to be a young woman with a choker around the neck. And that is often a giveaway because they use it to hide their Adam's apple or their Eve's apple. Eve was weak. With that expression on his face that you often see in pinups, it's that open-mouthed, you know, when they show a female model with her open mouth looking surprised or scared, but always sexually available, that open mouth, that's signaling sexual availability. It means exactly what you think it means. So this is how he wants you to see him. And this is ostensibly a confession and an apology. But what it really is a plea for attention and an attempt to make himself seem redeemed, blessed, bathed in the blood of the Lamb. It's like during some of those Protestant, Pentecostal, charismatic church services where you are called up to the altar to confess your sins. And you start crying and talking about what a terrible person you were, how you were lost and now you're found. And I'm not saying this can't be done genuinely, right? But in any situation like this, it can also be done very disingenuously by attention seekers. And that's what's going on here. So let me start with the first series of tweets in this confessional. Lefty Femme Girl
Ooh
says, okay, I can't live with this any longer. I was a dangerous man when I was younger. If I wasn't de-radicalized, I would have become a sexual predator. It escalated to the point I brought a girl to my house in high school and cornered her and tried to pressure her to have sex. So that's the opening move here. Notice you're being set up. You're being told here that all those bad things he used to be, he's not anymore. Okay, so that's how you're supposed to approach this. I was a dangerous man when I was younger. You're still a man. Next one. The memories of that haunt me now. The idea that I am some woman's worst experience. The two things going on here. One, how badly people write on Twitter. I want to quote accurately, but I will sometimes insert orally punctuation into what I'm speaking if it's not there in the original. But between the fact that I'm trying to make this clear to you as I read it out and the fact that it's written so badly, I'm stumbling over my words. So the memories of that moment haunt me now. The idea that I am some woman's worst experience ruins me. The fact that I used to jerk off to violent material, was an open misogynist, and wanted gore so often, scares me now. If I didn't de-radicalize myself, I don't know where I would be now. So now we've had two moves. I used to be this, I was terrible, but I'm not now. Where is this going? Here's where it's going. Now I live life on the other side. Now I am too often the victim of unwanted sexual advances and groped by creeps, and I can't help to think this is some form of karma for my past. I changed so much, sometimes I don't recognize old photos of myself as me anymore. What a crock of shit. Now, it's me. Now I understand how women feel when I treated them this way. Because now I am a woman. And now I get treated this way. No, you don't. No, you don't, young man. Everyone knows you're a man. Okay. To the extent that you're getting groped by what are known as chasers. Tranny chasers. You know who they are. They're creepy men at bars who have a fetish for transsexuals. Maybe there are some of them out there who would make genuinely good partners, and God bless you if that's the case. But we all know these men, and we all know the kind of character that men have who are fetishists for this kind of thing. They're more likely to be dangerous than just simply oddballs and diamonds in the rough. You're not getting groped all the time by people. That's nonsense. This is a fantasy. I'm taking all of this as if he is telling the truth about his thoughts and his past, and I can't know that, right? For the sake of argument, I'm taking it somewhat at face value. But it could just as easily be a recitation of fantasies in his head that never really took place, but that he wishes took place, that he's characterizing as a confession of his past sin. But he doesn't really disavow this. His fantasy is wrapped up in this, whether it's true or not. What he's telling you is the contents of his mind, not his redemption. He's getting off on this. He's getting off on the attention and the fawning that he gets from some very naive and stupid people who think that this is a legitimate and honest confession and demonstration of a reformed character. And if his character is what I suspect it is, and I suspect he has a cluster B personality disorder, which is so very, very common among trans-identified people, there's very little likelihood that his character is reformed. And if I'm right about this, he's not really trying to reform it. He is reforming his character because it gives him narcissistic supply and ego attention. And the best part, to the extent that he can fool anybody watching this, he's disarming them. He is breaking down their skepticism. He is appealing to their sympathetic emotions. Remember, I talked in the last segment about how liberals, I guess I would call it, the attitude that we're supposed to have today is empathy forward, right? Or sympathy, because when people say empathy, what they really mean is not simply understanding something from another's point of view. They mean to go farther. They mean sympathy. So not only understanding it, but pitying it, saying it's an understandable emotion. I absolutely understand it. Aren't you a poor little fragile thing here? Let mommy give you a big hug. Let's go to the next one. This is when it really starts to fall apart. This is where the mask should come off for everybody, but it doesn't. I was and am currently scared to tell you all this. I didn't want to ruin everyone's perception of me. I'm scared all of you would hate me for what I did, but the memories of that day keep eating away at me and ruin my own self-perception. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what this is about. To the extent that he's trying to fool, he's trying to fool other people, but to the extent that he's trying to fool himself, some of the truth is starting to peek through here. I'm scared you all would hate me for what I did. Well, it's reasonable, isn't it? Past behavior is the best indicator of future behavior. It's not foolproof, but it's the best indicator. And it's reasonable to fear and be skeptical of somebody who admits to what looks like borderline rape, right? I didn't want to ruin everyone's perception of me. Briar patching. I've talked about briar patching before. This is sort of convoluted and it's inverted in a way. He doesn't want to have you perceive him badly. That is true. But he's going into the briar patch. Oh, no, I don't want you to see me as this kind of person. He's confessing being this kind of person because he thinks that if he can confess that, you will see him as extraordinarily honest and that he's had a real change of heart and a real change of character. He's now morally centered enough to admit to what a bad person he was before. And doesn't that show you what a quality of character he has today? That's what he's doing. Next one. This is when people started to chime in and respond on the Twitter thread. Somebody named Crystal, 4 exclamation points, says, "It's good that you came clean about this." See? He got Crystal. He got Crystal. Lefty Femme Girl responds to Crystal saying, "Yeah, hopefully you see me as someone who can't do something like that anymore." Ba-dum, bum, bum. There it is, folks. There it is. Hopefully you see me as someone who can't do something like this anymore. Honestly, so ham-handed. If I were like this, I could do a much better job. He goes on, because you have to gild the lily. Too much is never enough with these people. I'll admit that the whole cancel culture thing made this even harder for me to get off my chest. Isn't that convenient? I was almost a victim of cancel culture. People are so mean and so bad and so unforgiving to people that I almost couldn't say it. I'm sorry. I know I'm acting and I'm being a little over the top about it. But I mean, really, this maudlin bullshit. Yeah, it's cancel culture. Cancel culture is so terrible. And it is. That's the thing. This is what they do. They pull in elements of truth that are going to resonate with you because you've had an experience of this, and they pervert it to serve their own dishonest, creepy ends. So cancel culture made this harder for me to get this off my chest. Seems like a ton of people on this site demand you always be perfect when you're not. I know some TERF or leftist will use this against me, but I still need to get it off my chest. TERF, trans-exclusionary radical feminist, the slur and the denigrating term they use for women who won't buckle under and say that they believe that men are women. They're trans-exclusionary radical feminists, and being exclusive, being exclusionary is the worst sin in our modern liberal culture. You have to be inclusive. Inclusive is just a smarmy, overused word for have no boundaries. So then we get another response. But you know you wouldn't do such a thing again, right? Honestly. And Lefty Femme Girl chimes right back in. Yes, I wouldn't do those things again. This is so dumb. This is so fucking dumb. And the last part, the pièce de résistance here, where I stopped looking at this thread, two more people chimed in at the end of this and said, "This is TERF bait. Shut the fuck up. Thanks." Next one. "You just loaded every TERF's gun. This isn't accountability. This is you trying to make yourself feel better about the fact that you are a predator and an attempted rapist. Absolutely disgusting and not reflective of the trans community at all. Go fuck yourself." That one's interesting because some of it's true. This person is right. This is, in fact, an attempt by a likely predator and a likely attempted rapist, if we're to believe what he says, to make himself look better. That's true. But notice that their primary concern isn't that this person is dangerous to other people. It's how it makes trans women look. "You just loaded every TERF's gun." Trans exclusionary radical feminist. Notice the reversal. Notice how these people talk about women who won't buckle under to this. They have a nasty acronym for them. But they take their violent thoughts, and many of these people, their heads are filled with violent imagery. Their art, such as it is filled with violent imagery. Choking, slapping women, pissing on them. And it gets worse from there. And then they try to say, you just loaded every TERF's gun. Like the women who are fighting to be recognized as women, the women who are saying, no, you may not let men into our rape shelters. No, you may not allow a young man to go into my daughter's locker room just because he claims he's a girl. They call them violent. They talk about their metaphorical gun. It's fucking perverse. It's a reversal. So I don't know if the thread went on after that, but I counted the responses on that thread to see how many were pro and how many were con. And I don't know, for what it's worth, I don't know how much this is worth. I don't know how indicative it is. But if you're curious, when I did the count, I found that 47 responses were negative, but 12 of them were positive. And of those 12 that were positive and supportive, it's impossible to tell. Of course, anybody can say anything on the internet about who they are. But it appeared that at least a few of those 12 supportive responses appeared to come from actual women, young women. The rest of them, I think, were quote unquote trans girls. So it's good that more people saw this for what it was than didn't, but that's a significant minority. And I see this all the time. I see it in social media. I see it happen on mainstream media. There are a lot of people who do fall for this, and it's worrisome. So how do we get here? How do we get to the place where there's enough of a sappy, dupable audience for this kind of nonsense that it's worth doing? Well, we do it through cult indoctrination that disguises itself as something else, that disguises itself as enlightenment, as a therapeutic exercise on the self to bring out a higher self and a deeper character to make you a better person. But what it really is cult techniques, taking things that are dangerous, things that are unreasonable to expect of people, and calling them love, calling them reasonable, calling them enlightened. So my friend George sent this image to me that was making the rounds, I think, in some social justice space on the media, on social media. And it's just an absolutely perfect example. We're going to do some translation of this one. So here's the image. It's a vertical graphic, and the title is Being Called Out / In. So we all know what called out means. You know, so-and-so called someone out, called them on bad behavior. Well, the really precious, smug and snuggly ones in this set like to talk about being called into. Don't think of it as being called out. Think of it as being called in for accountability to the community. So they've made an initialism, and the word that they used is claim, C-L-A-I-M. And they've expanded. I'm sure there's a word for this, and I'm just not thinking of it. You know, when you take a word and then you give a definition that starts with the letter of each letter of the word. So there's a definition for C, L, A, I, and M. Let's go. C, it's like Sesame Street. C is for center yourself. Center yourself. You're not being attacked. You're a good person. This is about your behavior and stopping harm to others. See? We don't hate you. We think you're a good person. We don't like your behavior. It's a didactic primary school teacher tone. I call it mommy tone sometimes when I talk about the way that people actually use their voices to do this. But the entire tone of this section of the left, first of all, it's very feminized. It's extraordinarily feminine. It's the tone that preschool teachers use, that soft, warm, but really condescending, babyish way of speaking characterizes them. So you're not being attacked. You're a good person. This is about your behavior and stopping harm to others. You're not being attacked. A lot of people, the kinds of people who use something like this attack all the time. They are attacking other people. They are. L is for listen. Don't interrupt or think of ways to defend yourself. Focus on learning what was harmful and being empathetic and compassionate. Don't interrupt or think of ways to defend yourself. Disarming you. They mean to disarm you. Don't defend yourself. What if you are actually being attacked? What if you're not being called in? What if you're being scapegoated? What if you are being accused of a harm that you did not perpetrate? There's no possibility in this religious ideology, and that's what this is. It's religious and cult. There's no possibility of that happening here. Don't defend yourself. Creepy. A is for acknowledge and apologize. Instead of explaining why you did it, acknowledge what happened and apologize, if needed or requested, for the harm you caused. It's all a foregone conclusion. Do you see that? There is no possibility that these people are mistaken. The only possibility is that you sinned. You erred. You harmed. You assaulted. Not them. You may not be blameless. Instead of explaining why you did it, acknowledge what happened and apologize. Acknowledge it. Acknowledge that, okay, I didn't actually attack anybody. I didn't actually insult them. I didn't actually lie about them. But since you experienced it that way, that's your truth, I won't explain it away because that would be a further act of assault. I'll simply acknowledge that you're right and I'll apologize for it. This is abuse. This is training. This is what my friend George said. He said to me, how is this not an example of teaching people how to be abused and accept it? Well, the answer to his question is that is what this is. I is for inquire. See? Big-hearted and open-minded. Inquire. Let your mind be open to becoming a bigger person and more aware of other people's truths. Inquire. If they consent and have the time and resources, ask what you could have done instead and how to make amends for what happened. Look at all the qualifiers here. Inquire, but be careful. Be careful. Make sure they're okay with you inquiring. How can you do that? Do you ask them if they're okay? Because it's related to this concept of emotional labor, which is a term that was very frequently used. I believe that it was originally coined. I don't remember who coined it. I think it was originally coined to talk about the emotional work that commonly falls to women in a family system. And this is true. Birthday parties, remembering parents' anniversaries, sending condolence letters, baking birthday cakes, these sorts of things, whether you approve of this or not, have tended traditionally to fall on the women in the family. And there is a good argument to be made that there are some women who feel very burdened by this, who feel like they shouldn't have to be the ones in the family unit who does all of this, what they call emotional labor. So you can have a conversation about this in a well-defined context that isn't a crazy conversation. But of course, all of this stuff has been taken out of context and inflated. So that although they don't use the term emotional labor, that's the concept that's behind this. You know, inquire if they consent. How will you know if they consent? Because the act of asking them if they consent to you inquiring is a form of inquiry. You cannot win here. And if they have the time and resources, it's like, have you ever seen those memes? Somebody teaching a class on critical race theory or recognizing your latent white supremacy. And they talk about, you know, do your own work, educate yourself. Don't put your emotional labor on me. Or if you do, pay me. Cash me at this app. Cash me. Pay a black woman her worth. Pay a woman her worth. Give me money. Piss off. Finally, M. M is for moving forward. The best apology is changed behavior. If they gave you reasonable recommendations and amends, do them. Well, how will you know if they're reasonable? You have to inquire. And we've already established that you can't inquire unless you know what their disposition is first. They give you, how will you, are you allowed to evaluate whether you think their recommendations are reasonable? Are you allowed to have an opinion on whether the form of amends that they demand from you is reasonable and commensurate to the crime, the alleged crime? I don't think you are. Don't do the harm again. Use this experience to help others learn too. Yeah. So once we've browbeaten you, once we've gaslit you, once we've broken you down emotionally and convinced you that you've been a bad person, take that lesson and not only use it to improve yourself, but use it to improve other people too. Forward the abuse. Pay it forward. That's what this is. It's cult dynamics. It's cult indoctrination. And it's softening people up. And it's normalizing abuse. This is psychological abuse. Come back and we're going to talk about psychopathy at Yale. See you after the break. Thanks so much for listening. Would you take just a minute right now and share our show on social media? On Disaffected, we take a close look every week at the abuse dynamics exploding in the dark and disordered world that we live in. Tell other people about us. And when you subscribe, hit that notification bell and stay with us in real time as we take a new close look every week and examine how to identify and contend with the abuse dynamics at play in the world around us. Welcome back. I think some of you will have heard of this because it made a lot of news. I'm going to play you a short clip in a minute from a lecture at the Yale School of Medicine by Yale psychiatrist Aruna Kilanani. And it's quite incredible. This was a talk that she gave at the Yale School of Medicine during Grand Rounds, which is an educational practice that's done in medical schools for students, where they get prominent physicians. This woman happens to be a psychiatrist, which means that she's also a medical doctor, but she has a specialty in the medical side of diseases of the mind as well. And I'm going to ask you to think about this and ask yourself if this is an example, another example of confession. When we talk about abusive people, personality disordered people, we often note that when they accuse other people of wrongdoing, the kinds of accusations that they level at other people are often inadvertent confessions of what's inside their own mind. It's so common that it's classic, right? When I had the great rupture with my mother in 2016, this is a good time to plug some of our back catalog here. If this is the first time you're watching the show, or only the first or second or third time, if you're curious about why this show has the theme that it does and why I talk about these things, I explained that in the first episode called Mommy Issues. The very short version is my mother has borderline and narcissistic personality disorders. These are cluster B personality disorders. My childhood was psychologically and physically violent, deranged, and abusive. It looked like something that you would expect to see in a made-for-TV movie. If you're curious about what this looks like, what life looks like behind closed doors, out of the public eye, go back and listen to or watch the two-part episode, Over the Borderline, where I describe in detail what growing up with a mother with borderline personality disorder was actually like by comparing my experience to some popular films that most people have heard of, Mommy Dearest, the story of actress Joan Crawford and her adopted daughter Christina Crawford, as well as Carrie, the adaptation of the Stephen King novel, which of course is fiction, but features a mother, Margaret, Carrie's mother, who displays what is to me obvious borderline personality disorder and derangement. And when I had that rupture with my mother in 2016, it changed my life. I finally understood what personality disorders were. It made sense of my past. It made sense of the deranged and nonsensical behavior of my mother. And it was the first time in my life that I ever drew a line and drew a boundary. I had my mother living in a house that I owned. It was a very bad mistake. And over the two-year period, her instability, her craziness, and her viciousness, her vicious exploitation, lying, was ruining my peace of mind. It was ruining my life. And I had to kick her out. And as I started this process, my mother began to accuse me of everything that was wrong with her. In texts, in really crazy emails. One of them was a 5-page long letter that came in at 4:30 in the morning where she suggested that I was sociopathic. She suggested that I had narcissistic personality disorder. She made up events that never happened, and then she claimed that events that actually did happen where she was abusive to her children were fantasies and creations that we children had made up. It was like a mirror. Everything that was wrong with her bounced right off her, and she said it was us. So as we listen to this clip and watch this clip, I want you to ask yourself if you think this is an example of accusations actually being confessions. This talk is about what Aruna Kilalani says is the psychopathic mind of white people. It's a short clip. And the audio is very, very hard to hear. There is no better source. What you're seeing and hearing here is all that's available to anybody. So we have captioned this, and I will read what she says because it's very difficult to hear. So let's go right into it as I put my big ugly cans on. So what she said was, white people make my blood boil. I had fantasies of unloading a revolver into the head of any white person that got in my way, burying their body, and wiping my bloody hands as I walked away relatively guiltless with a bounce in my step. Nice touch, huh? Like I did the world a fucking favor. That's not all she said. This, I believe this was about a 55-minute lecture. And former New York Times and Wall Street Journal writer Barry Weiss very helpfully excerpted and transcribed even more from that. I want to share a few more pieces with you. Remember, folks, this woman is a psychiatrist. She's a lecturer at Yale School of Medicine. This was a lecture she gave to medical school students. A couple other quotes. White people are out of their minds, and they have been for a long time. We are now in a psychological predicament because white people feel that we are bullying them when we bring up race. They feel that we should be thanking them for all that they have done for us. They are confused, and so are we. We keep forgetting that directly talking about race is a waste of our breath. We are asking a demented, violent predator who thinks that they are a saint or a superhero to accept responsibility. It ain't gonna happen. They have 5 holes in their brain. It's like banging your head against a brick wall. It's just like sort of not a good idea. accusation or confession? What do you think? We are asking a demented, violent predator, are we? Who's the demented, violent predator? Who's the one who fantasized about unloading a revolver into the head of any white person that got in my way, burying their body, and wiping my bloody hands as I walked away, relatively guiltless, with a bounce in my step, like I did the world a fucking favor? Who's the demented, violent predator here? You know what that sounds like to me? That sounds like a psychopath. That's what psychopathy sounds like. Notice the glibness. Notice the way she describes unloading a revolver into the head of any white person that got in my way. Burying their body. Walking away relatively guiltless with a bounce in my step like I did the world a fucking favor. The glib pleasure that she takes in fantasizing about this, that sounds like something a psychopath would say. And Yale School of Medicine, not unprompted, only when the shit hit the fan in the media, Yale Medical School did denounce her. I don't think their language was nearly strong enough. But that's no balm to this problem. Because we need to ask how this woman got where she got. I don't believe for a moment that this was a singular kind of lecture that she gave. I don't really believe in people who are normal and stable, who just every once in a while give a lecture like this, where they talk about the content, the filthy, violent, murderous contents of their mind and their fantasy world. You can be sure that this woman has given off tells about the kind of person she is long before she gave this lecture. If I'm right about the state of her mind, and I cannot be sure, I don't know her outside of the context of this. But what context is there? What context is there that would make this less sinister than it truly is? I'm having a hard time imagining it. So how did she get here? How many people ignored the warning signs? How many people were intimidated? Has she threatened people before? Has she silenced people before with threats? I don't know, but it certainly would be in keeping with the kind of character that I suspect she has. And this made me think, and I'm going to do some work on this because I want to talk about this on a future show. I want to know, do schools of psychiatry or schools for mental health professionals, excuse me, do they have a system to detect and weed out potentially dangerous or unsuitable people before they are awarded a doctorate or a medical degree? I'd really like to know. Because, you know, I have friends who are academics. And I've watched friends climb up the academic ladder from poverty and eating ramen noodles in graduate school to getting a tenure job at a university or a liberal arts college. And so I've seen some of the administration that goes on behind the scenes in an academic's life. And at least among my academic friends who I know, they have clauses in their contract about moral turpitude, bad behavior. So when you're tenured, it's very, very difficult to lose your job. The university is making a commitment. They are saying that you, the academic, have passed a rigorous test. We think that you are of value to our university, and we want to give you security and a stable job because we want your long-term presence here for the good of our student body. But there are certain things that academics can do that will get them fired. And these often happen under what are, they're often delineated under moral turpitude clauses. Are there moral turpitude clauses at medical schools? Are there similar provisions in contracts for schools that confer graduate degrees on licensed mental health professionals? Is there a system? And I don't know the answer to this. I've only looked at it in a very cursory way. And if any of you know any resources that you could point me to, shoot us an email, us@disaffected.fm. I'd appreciate any leads. Thank you very much. But it seems to me that a school that is going to confer a degree, a mental health degree, on a professional, and especially if a school is going to confer a medical degree on a psychiatrist is not merely a licensed mental health counselor. This is a medical doctor who's gone all the way through medical school and who did a specialization in psychiatry on top of that. Do they test personalities? And I'm not talking about that bullshit Myers-Briggs crap, okay? I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about things like the Narcissistic Personality Inventory or Robert Hare's, and I don't remember the formal name, but he has a test that's like the Narcissistic Personality Inventory to detect psychopathy. Do they have these things? I should bloody well hope so. Because if you're putting your university's imprimatur on someone, and you are, you're branding them past the highest standards, past the Yale test, should be able to go out into the world as a degreed psychiatrist and treat people? Are you doing anything to detect in the students who matriculate in your program whether or not they have a Cluster B personality disorder? Because you should. Cluster B personality disorders are not just depression or anxiety. They're fundamental character flaws. That family includes borderline personality disorder, the floridly unstable people, narcissistic personality disorder, which is self-explanatory, histrionic personality disorder, and antisocial personality disorder, which is another name for psychopathy. These are called the erratic and dramatic personality disorders. And anecdotally, and not just my anecdotes, but from people who work in the field, there are many people out there, and I am one of them, who believe that the vast majority, not all of it, but the very big majority of the mental health problems that drive people to therapy often come from spouses and parents or significant others who are personality disordered and who are abusing these people. Giving a psychiatry degree to a psychopath is literally putting a no, it's not literally, I'm exaggerating. It's figuratively putting a loaded gun in their hands. But it may not be much of an exaggeration. The damage these people can do is incalculable. And they don't have to actually be killers. They don't have to be murderers. They can trick you. They can manipulate you. They can seduce you. They can steal from you while making you think that you're giving them a gift. Very troubling. It's all I have to say about that for now, but I'm going to do some research about this because I want to know the answer. I want to know what these schools are doing to detect this because, and I don't have numbers on this, but I'd be willing to bet that the number of personality disordered people in the mental health fields is higher than you'd find in the background population. Anecdotal, yeah. But a lot of people have anecdotes like that. And I have noticed, I have seen many therapists. I've observed from a distance. I've looked at them. I've watched their videos. And I'm convinced that they have borderline personality disorder. But when you get up into the psychiatrists, you know, the really high academic level stuff, I've met some of them. I've worked around some of them. I've observed them like I have with other people. And I've seen a number of them that to me look like they qualify as fully disordered narcissists. This worries me. Should worry you. Should worry these schools, and I hope it does. The last thing I want to talk about here is about parental estrangement, parent-child estrangement. As a proponent of estrangement in the right contexts. I take an interest in seeing how the public talks about this phenomenon. And I've talked before about how difficult it is for many people to fully take on board how abusive mothers can be. The classic image of the abusive parent that we're all familiar with is usually the abusive father or husband. And there's a good reason for that, because men and women are different. Men are physically stronger than women on average. Most men are stronger than most women. And when there is violence in the home, the man is generally more dangerous to the woman. If there's going to be severe battering, it's usually going to be the man beating the woman. If one of the partners is going to get killed, it's usually the man killing the woman or the child. We know, of course, that there are deranged and abusive mothers, but we don't act as though we really know that it's true. We think that, well, it's very, very rare, right? It's like Susan Smith, who drowned her kids in a lake. We hear these sensational stories of the Medean mother who kills her children. And it is, thank God, it's rare. It's not unheard of, but it's rare. But that isn't the entire, that's not the entire universe of abusive mothers. And I think people can't see it, because the kinds of abuse that women can dish out is usually less physical. I mean, my mother beat me. She beat her other children too. But she didn't beat me nearly as hard as her husband did, the guy who tried to kill her. And he did try to kill her, tried to murder her in front of her children. But so people have a hard time seeing it in mothers, I think partly because the image of the mother that we need to believe in, the best example of the mother, the best that mothers can be. Mothers are so foundationally important. And we want to believe in the loving mother. And thankfully, most mothers are loving. Some aren't. But we also have this problem understanding the severity of parental abuse. And we question children who cut their parents off. And I don't know where we fall on this. If you were to give a poll to the average American, I don't know how many of them would say one thing versus another. But it seems to me that a great number of people seem to default sympathetically to the parent who was cut off by their child and assume that the child must be selfish, the child must be ungrateful, the child must somehow just be a nasty, petty little narcissistic kid who cuts his parent off for flippant reasons. I don't know why we make that assumption, because that is true. I mean, there are children like this, right? And there are parents who are unfortunate enough to have been good, loving parents who ended up with a child who was a psychopath or otherwise personality disordered. That does happen. Doesn't happen a lot, folks. Most of the time, if you can examine the background of someone with a cluster B personality disorder, the overwhelming majority of the time, parental abuse happened. So it's kind of funny to me that we make that default assumption. Because if, in fact, it's true that that child is a petty little narcissist, where do you think they got it from? Oh, I don't know. They were just born that way. A few of them, not most of them. So I want to contrast two different approaches to this. I saw an article from The Economist magazine this week. I'll take a look at how it appeared on social media. Here's the headline. How many American children have cut contact with their parents? And the strap line is, the relationship most commonly severed is that between parent and adult child, and in most cases, it is the child who wields the knife. Right off the bat, they've introduced a heavy bias to this. And I thought at first that that was just a bad headline that didn't reflect the article, because if you don't know this, most of the time in journalism, if you write a piece, you don't get to write the title. When I was a newspaper reporter, I never got to write the titles of my pieces. An editor or a sub-editor does that. So if you ever see a terrible headline, don't be angry at the writer. It's almost never the case that she wrote the headline. Someone editing did. And if you get a bad editor or somebody with a hair across their ass, they can often write a headline that directly contradicts the content of the article. But this was not one of those cases. That's a line lifted directly from the writer in the middle of the piece. And throughout this whole piece, very little attention is given to the cases where an adult child estranges himself from a parent because the parent was abusive. It's given a mention in two places, but all of the descriptions and all of the emotive language and all of the quotations from parents who have been cut off by their children are framed in a way that is sympathetic to the parents and that suggests by implication or by silence that the children committed a moral wrong against their parents. Let me read you a few pieces of this article. Unhappily married for many years, Peter waited until his children were grown up before he divorced their mother. He hoped this would make the experience less upsetting for them. Yet in the 6 years since, he's not seen either of his two sons. He speaks to the younger one, who's in his 20s, once or twice a year. The eldest, in his 30s, has cut off all contact. His middle child, a daughter, has at times tried to act as a go-between, an experience she found distressing. Quote, "For me, it's been completely devastating," Peter says. "I get on with my life, but I get teary when I think about them." End quote. "Losing contact with children is like bereavement," he says, "but with the painful tug of hope that they might one day be reconciled." It's a lot missing, isn't there? Peter and his wife got divorced. Why did they get divorced? We don't know. Did the writer ask? We don't know. Why did his children choose to stop talking to him after the divorce? We don't know. But the sympathetic way that this is framed suggests to me that the writer would like us to think that it must have been the mother poisoning them against Peter. We hear Peter talking about how he gets tears in his eyes when he thinks about this and how painful it is. And that may well be true. But it could also be true that Peter is a bastard and that his divorcing his wife, the mother of his children, was the catalyst that finally said to his children, "Enough, I'm not taking my shitty dad anymore. I'm not taking his abuse." We don't know. But this is framed in such a way to make us sympathetic to Peter and to make us question his wife and his children. Another section says, it's the subheading for this section of this article, "Me, Myself, and I." A rise in individualism that emphasizes personal happiness is the biggest factor. People are increasingly likely to reject relatives who obstruct feelings of well-being in some way by holding clashing beliefs or failing to embrace those of others. Personal fulfillment has increasingly come to displace filial duty, says Dr. Coleman. Whereas families have always fought and relatives fallen out, he says, the idea of cutting oneself off from a relative as a path to one's own happiness seems to be new. Again, this is framed as if this is a glib consumer choice made in a petty way with a light touch by children who can't think deeply about the moral implications of cutting off their parents. The last sentence gives some acknowledgement to what may be going on. It says, in some ways, it's a positive development. People find it easier to separate from parents who've been abusive, but it can also carry heavy costs. As if this is just all like this, right? It's all even. Well, you know, it might be a positive development if they find their parents abusive, but it has heavy costs. And there's one other place, one other sentence in there that alludes to the fact that sometimes the children say their parents are abusive, but most of the copy here assumes that the parents have been unfairly estranged from their children. There's just really a pronounced bias. And then they go on to talk about individualism and children treating this like a consumer choice. Now, I'm willing to entertain the idea that there may be an increase in the number of children who are cutting off their parents for petty, consumeristic, narcissistic reasons, because more people are in fact petty, consumeristic, and narcissistic. We talk about this on the show all the time. That may well be true. But the bias in this article is so pronounced. And they close with an anecdote that's meant to tug at your heartstrings. People who work with the elderly should consider the possibility, said Dr. Pillemer, that an old person is not receiving the support and solace that might be assumed about someone who has adult children. Quote, Mrs. Smith may say she has two daughters, says Dr. Pelamer. She's quite likely not to add that she never sees them. You know, it's the poor old woman sitting there suffering in silence because her children have cut her off. Again, I'm sure there are cases where the children are ungrateful and they are mistreating their parents. But the entire assumption behind this, and this is an assumption that you see in a lot of popular discourse. People don't like to credit. I would guess, my guess, is that most children who estrange their parents have legitimate reasons to do so. Maybe not all, maybe not a vast majority, but I would say most. I could be wrong about that. I don't know if anyone's actually doing any work on that. That's a good topic for research. But if you'd like another side to that, and I'm not going to go into it in any great detail, but if you are interested in this, there's a website I recommend that you look at called Isendai, and I'll spell it for you. Issendai. Type in Isendai and estranged parents, and you'll come up with this woman's website. She did a close analysis of internet message boards and forums for estranged parents, analyzed them, tried to find out the backstory, and what she found certainly tracks with my experience, that parents who claim to be estranged on these forums very often painted themselves as innocent victims who had only ever done loving things to their children, telling vague, emotionally laden stories about how ungrateful their daughters or sons were, but without any supporting detail and without ever admitting that their children might have had reasons to do this. And that kind of excuse-making is very, very common with abusive people, personality disorder people. It's not me, it's my kids. All my kids are crazy. She's just my mother, right? Two of her children, my sister and I, don't speak to her. I haven't spoken to her in 5 years and never will speak to her again. My brother might see her once every few months, frankly, by his own admission, to assuage his guilt. He feels guilty not talking to our mother. That's his life. He can do what he wants. He has no reason to feel guilty. But sure, it's us three kids. We're all crazy. I know everybody's experience isn't mine. But a lot of adult children have had an experience like the one I've had and that my siblings have had. So to close this out, I would ask you to think about the power dynamics that are going on behind situations that are described this way. Use discernment. Ask questions. Consider the motivations, the likely motivations of each side of the story, and see which seems more believable to you. The left's brainwashing, cultural brainwashing that we are swimming around in and have been swimming around in, the idea that we are a racist country primarily, that we are a homophobic, transphobic, misogynistic country, that most interactions in the workplace and in the home are conducted along lines of abuse, of poor, impoverished minorities. This drumbeat has been drilled into us for years, and it has shut down our critical faculties, and it has put us, it has reversed victim and offender, right? The people who claim to be victims often turn out to be the people who've been abusive to other people. Don't let them take vocabulary away from you. Just because narcissists don't like the fact that they're called narcissists, you don't need to listen to them when they say, stop calling it narcissistic abuse. Stop saying that your ex is a narcissist. Everyone says that. It's overused. It's just people being petty. Some people believe that, but a lot of the people who say that the most loudly are in fact narcissists, whether they know it or not, and some of them do. They want to take that vocabulary away from you because they want to disarm you. If you had a gun, they'd find a way to take the gun away from you so that you couldn't defend yourself in a situation where you needed to. That's what this is about. Don't let them disarm you. Don't let them take concepts away from you. Don't let them take language that describes their abuse away from you. And for goodness sake, do not let them convince you to beat your sword into a plowshare. I'll see you next week.